For over a century, the medium of radio has created a unique intimacy between broadcasters and their audience like no other art form. Echoing and celebrating the changing face of popular culture, radio stars occupy a certain space in the story of entertainment. In this series, some of Britain's most recognisable voices reflect on their own relationship with the original content creator. So, join us as we celebrate the power and magic of radio exclusively on Beyond the Title.
Veteran writer and broadcaster Paul Gambaccini has been presiding over the ever-changing musical landscape for over half a century and began as a writer for Rolling Stone, commencing in 1970, continuing through a decade. Paul celebrated his 40th anniversary as a national broadcaster on the 5th of October 2013. Making his BBC radio debut in 1973, Gambaccini saw the radio station through its primitive years of rustic music presentation until Matthew Bannister's revolution in 1993. The co-author of the Guinness Book of British Hit Singles, Gambaccini has become one of Britain's most trusted authorities on the history of the music industry, appearing on countless documentaries surrounding popular culture. In 2016, Gambaccini replaced the great Tony Blackburn as the host of Radio 2's Pick of the Pops and was one of the founding broadcasters on the digital station Greatest Hits Radio. I caught up with the broadcasting titan to talk music, entertainment and his recollections on an unparalleled career in broadcasting. Ladies and gentlemen, the legendary Paul Gambaccini.
So we'll get on to your many major highlights in a second, but growing up in New York City, what was it about British culture which made you want to experience it for yourself?
The Beatles. I have to say, to be alive in your time, you must engage with what there is in your time. And in my time, meaning when I was a teenager, there was the Beatles. And I remember when I first heard them. It was Christmas week, 1963. I was on the porch of my family home in Westport, Connecticut, listening to Stan Z. Burns. They use Z rather than Z in America. On radio station WINS, New York. And he said, and this was about 1:35 in the afternoon, I've had a request from the English workers on the ships on the west side of Manhattan. In Britain, these are known as the Cunard Yanks. They're the sailors who did the trips between Britain and America at that time. And they would like to hear the number one record in their country, I Want to Hold Your Hand by the Beatles. Now, bear in mind, the Beatles had not had a hit in the United States yet. And all of their releases had been leased by EMI to different labels. So there was no coordination in their presentation. But somehow, I Want to Hold Your Hand blew a dog whistle that millions of people of my generation heard at the same time, even though they were isolated. Remember, there's no social media or internet in those days. And within a month, it was number one. And of course, within 6 weeks, they were on Ed Sullivan and 73 million people watched them. So I remembered that. And it was what there was. And so I went to college in America, deliberately to the college that had the largest radio station in America run by students. And so I began broadcasting in 1966.
Yeah. And as a writer for the Rolling Stone magazine, you were right at the beating heart of pop culture, where arguably you've remained ever since. In an era before social media, how significant do you think music journalists were in capturing the collective mood of the time?
I remember Alan Freeman, the great presenter of Pick of the Pops in 1970. And he said that we are the mediators. It is our job to give music to the public because the public could not access it any other way. As I say, there was no social media, there was no internet. So it really was our responsibility to choose the best. In our reviews, give accurate and informed judgments. And so I started doing that with Rolling Stone magazine while I was still a student at Dartmouth. This was in 1970. And we did everything by post because there was no other way of getting text from one place to another except through the mail. And then I applied to Oxford because I couldn't stand President Nixon. And so I came to, I won a scholarship to Oxford University and I came over to Britain. That's how I got to Britain. I went into London, visited the Rolling Stone office, got assignments from the Rolling Stone office in London. And in late 72 and 73, met John Peel and his producer, John Walters. And John Walters invited me to give a weekly talk on Radio One, starting in the autumn of 1973. So that's how it all began. But we were all very aware of our important responsibility to pick the best music and to present it to everyone. And this is why some of the leading presenters of the 70s are very different from some of the leading presenters of today, because they were more music oriented rather than personality oriented, if you see what I mean. And I think I've enjoyed a longer career because I have a musical knowledge, but that comes from loving music and having to know it to do my job in the early 70s.
Yeah, so Josh has asked, you know, when joining Radio One in those early days, researching around that subject, it appears that there was always a sort of raw, informal atmosphere. How do you think that encouraged creativity?
Well, Josh, you make me laugh with the words raw, informal. There were two universes at Radio One. There was what was called the fourth floor, which was the daily shows like Tony Blackburn and David Hamilton. And then there was the third floor, which was the evening and weekend shows. And this was people like myself and John Peel and Alan Freeman and Kenny Everett and Nightingale. And their unofficial slogan was ratings by day, credibility by night. So they would get their ratings from people like Tony Blackburn and David Hamilton. But the serious work was being done in the evenings and on the weekends. And this is where several people establish reputations of great credibility. And a couple of those people survive today, of course. Anne Nightingale is still on Radio 1. Bob Harris is still on Radio 2. Johnny Walker is still on Radio 2.
Yeah. So over the years on Beyond the Title, we've spoken to many different musicians and broadcasters about the revolution of Radio 1, both on both sides of the landmark, who obviously have different opinions on things. But as a long-standing broadcaster, how did you feel about Matthew Bannister's decision to return the station to its youth demographic roots?
Well, you are referring to the 1994-95 purge of the older DJs.
Yeah.
And I am a historian, so I've always been interested in the music of today and the music of yesterday and the music of tomorrow. But I, even now, I learn about the music from before my birth. Classical music, of course, because that's always been a great interest of mine. Mm-hmm. But even I hear recordings I've not heard before from stars before my birth, like Billie Holiday and Ella Fitzgerald and Bessie Smith. George Gershwin, of course. And as a historian of music, you should want to know the best music from every period. So I was not surprised that Matthew wanted, under instructions from upper management, by the way, this was not his theory. He was told to do this. I didn't think they would want to throw away the knowledge of the past. I said to John Peel, who was kept on because nobody would dare fire John Peel, there would have been an uproar. But I said, I wasn't surprised that they got rid of someone like Simon Bates or Dave Lee Travis, because they were now getting older and they didn't have any musical credibility. But when they got rid of myself and Bob Harris and Johnny Walker, they got rid of the knowledge. And so the station didn't have the knowledge anymore. And I thought, well, that is an important decision, whether conscious or not. And as a result, the ratings plummeted, as you probably, well, there's no way you can know this, actually. We had peaked in the late 70s at 25 million listeners a week. By the time Matthew Bannister was appointed, it was still at 19 million a week. And as listeners were being shed by the bucket load, every rating period, hundreds of thousands of people were leaving. And finally, Mark Goodyear went into Matthew Bannister and said, Matthew, how low are you going to take this? And he said, 10 million. He had been told to lose half the audience. And of course, they slightly overshot. It went down to 9.6, had a brief dead cat bounce, but it's been drifting downwards ever since. Last Rajar ratings, it was 7.67 million. So it never recovered. But you could say it was a success. I mean, they would ironically say, well, we did what we said we were going to do. We got a younger audience, which, of course, they have to constantly redo to keep a younger audience, or at least think that they do. So that really was the point where Radio One defined itself as a station that was going to follow the age demographic rather than the music. Some artists, most famously Status Quo, but some artists just stopped being played on Radio One. And I think young people are a bit more sophisticated than they're given credit for. There have always been records that never made the Radio One playlist because they were doomed to be considered Radio 2 records. I mean, this goes back to 1974. Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me by Elton John was not put on the Radio 1 A-list because it was considered to be a Radio 2 record. And Celine Dion, My Heart Will Go On. There are several ballads who fell into this category. But if the kids love them, the kids love them. Anyway, ours is not to do or die. Our job is to, as Steve Wright said, surf the controllers. You just try and hang in there, regardless of what the policy decisions are.
Yeah. So as a music journalist, you've been to countless gigs and seen live performances from a whole range of different musical superstars. But in your opinion, what makes a great concert?
Well, it's a combination of artistry and the moment. And also where you are in your own head as a music fan. Because there are people who will say, oh my God, the pyramid stage at Glastonbury, so-and-so, it was incredible. Well, to some people, it wasn't incredible because they thought they were witnessing the artist's past peak, or their own interest had drifted somewhere else to different styles of music. So you have to be interested in the artist. The artist has to really come through. And it helps if there's a sense of occasion. I have to say, when I think of my favorite gigs, the one that just left me bowled over the most was James Brown in a theater in the Round in Connecticut in 1966. Now, the moment was that James Brown had just broken through from the rhythm and blues audience, which is a very polite way of saying the black core audience, to the wider integrated audience with three consecutive top 10 hits. Papa's Got a Brand New Bag, I Got You, I Feel Good, and It's a Man's, Man's, Man's World. And this was really exciting. This was his moment. He was crossing over. He gave a dynamite performance. And I was right at my peak of interest and my love of rhythm and blues. And I just thought, well, I've never seen anything as exciting as this. He did what they used to call the cape act, which is where he would pretend to be overcome and he would fall to the stage sweating and weak. And his assistant would come on with a cape and put it on him and pick him up again. And then he would fight and shake off the cape and he'd go back to the microphone and do it again. And then it would go back and forth. It was a shtick, as they say in America. I mean, that was his routine, but it was thrilling. So James Brown was great. And then when Brian Wilson came to do Smile. He came to do a concert of the Smile album at the Royal Festival Hall. And this was when Brian Wilson was returning to performance after an extended period of being out of it, as people know. And it was just so thrilling to see him do this classic work. And he did do Smile, and then on a second tour he did Pet Sounds, and that was amazing because it was an incredible event that this great artist had returned from his profound mental difficulties. It was a thrilling triumph. And of course, some of the great events were thrills for me, but part of that was because I was working on that's Live Aid, Nelson Mandela concert. Those particular two stay in my mind. But Live Aid was the peak of, I came home at 5:30 in the morning. And my PA was still up. He'd watched the whole thing. And I said, that was the peak of all of our careers. We hadn't seen it coming. We had no idea of knowing it was going to be as successful as it was. But I just knew, well, okay, we have just had the first transmission of a concert from one country to another. The next comparable advance would be a broadcast from Earth to another heavenly body, which is not going to happen in my lifetime. So this is it. I mean, this is the highlight of our career. And here we are 37 years later, and I would still say that. Now, of course, part of it was because everything was perfect about the day. From the performance of Queen, which has become legendary, the weather was great. Donations were successful. It was a major financial success. But it was and also there was just the cultural uplift of we, meaning our generation of artists and broadcasters, have got together to actually do something worthwhile. And that was really a feeling that gave us a sense of accomplishment.
Yeah. Awesome.
Hey.
Josh said, how do you think Live Aid pushed music broadcasting on?
Well, it forced, there are always occasional developments that force the establishment to take popular music more seriously. To give another example, the death of Elvis Presley was originally not covered as a lead story. It was just part of the news. But when people responded around the world as dramatically as they did, it moved up the news cycle, if you see what I mean. Now, with Live Aid, it was promoted, if I'm right, on BBC television. They hadn't intended, either it went from BBC Two onto BBC One while it was happening, or else they extended the commitment until it was over in the early morning hours from Philadelphia. But it was growing as we were doing it. but it was being taken more seriously. And these things happen. I remember also, I was, oh my God, it's hard to say that you co-hosted a funeral, but Trevor Nelson and I co-hosted the coverage, the television feed of the funeral of Michael Jackson, which started in the early evening, our time. And every 15 minutes, the ratings went up. Now, in the evenings, television ratings traditionally go down because people go to bed, and they have dinner, they go away. And more people were watching with each passing quarter hour, which showed you the incredible amount of interest in Michael Jackson. So the media themselves learned from the response of the public to the broadcasts.
Yeah. So 1992, now you became a founding personality on the UK's classical music station, Classic FM. What's the correlation between classical music and pop?
Well, classical music was the popular music of its time. I mean, obviously, there would have been folk music. There would have been sacred music. But classical music, as we now call it, was the lingua franca musically of its period. I tend to say to people, there have been two times in history, musically, when either you were there or you weren't. And you can appreciate the music from these periods, whether you were there or not, but to enjoy the spirit of it, you had to be there. And the first of these was Vienna, the first third of the 19th century, when the lives of Beethoven, Mozart, and Schubert overlapped.
Mm.
Now, granted that you had to be fairly privileged to have access to these concerts, because remember, these weren't arenas. I mean, these were houses or official rooms in palaces. But nonetheless, to be there for a Beethoven premiere would have been a thrill, a major Beethoven premiere. It was what was being published as sheet music at the time. This is how the music was disseminated because there were no recordings. So that would have been an incredibly exciting period. And the second time is the 60s, the 1960s. The great youth quake. And there was just this explosion of expression following on from the first youth quake of the mid-50s, which was Elvis and rock and roll and rhythm and blues. But the 60s was extraordinary from the out... The point of people choosing to communicate with each other in this way, in the way they do now via social media, but then it was via pop music. And dialogues were going on in pop music, and the greatest talents of the period were making records. They weren't doing other things. And so we had this amazing range of quality from the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and the Who and the Kinks from Britain. From America, the Bob Dylan, Simon and Garfunkel, and of course, Motown, the greatest single independent record label of all time, with Marvin Gaye, Stevie Wonder, Jackson 5, Diana Ross and the Supremes, Temptations, Smokey Robinson, The Miracles, Four Tops. I can go on. I mean, it's a miracle, miracle company. And of course, the great rhythm and blues artists such as Aretha Franklin, Otis Redding. Everybody was communicating via the same form, which was music. And to this day, there are more people I know from the 60s who know their hits than from the 80s or 90s. Not that the people from the 80s and 90s don't love their music, but they didn't have to invest as much of themselves to enjoy it, because in the 60s, you had to go out to a record store to buy a record. You couldn't hear it over the internet. There were no genre record shows like Pete Tong's dance show on Radio 1. So everything took an effort. Until Radio 1 came in Britain, you had to make an effort to listen to Radio Luxembourg through the crackle in the evenings, or listen to the pirate ships, or listen to the 4 or 5 hours a week of pop music on BBC Radio. In other words, you really had to put yourself out to get the music you wanted. And as a consequence, you just loved it more because it was yours. Nowadays, music has triumphed, but it's become part of the wallpaper of life. It is everywhere now. You can consume whatever song you want, whenever you want, but there's less of you in it because you didn't have to have an appointment to listen. You didn't have to say, I'm only going to be able to hear this at 8 o'clock on a Monday night. Or I'm going to have to go to the record store to get this record. So for those of us who had to go to the record stores, the music of that period is more precious than the music from later periods, just because it's part of ourselves.
Yeah. So not too long after joining Classic FM, you had chosen to front a documentary celebrating Cilla Black's 30th anniversary in show business. What was the most surprising thing you learned about her during the making of the programme?
Well, I liked Cilla a lot. Everybody likes Cilla. But what I learned the most from that was her love for her husband, Bobby. When you were at her house, and I mean, you just saw how she deferred to him, not in a way of gender role model, but in terms of advice. What's good for her? He knew her, and she knew he knew her. And it was like having two of her in terms of what should we do. I really learned how close they were. And of course, meeting her a few times after his death, it was obvious that she was distressed for a long time. The other thing I learned about Cilla from my work was the bizarre way in which Dionne Warwick saw her as a nemesis. Because Cilla had a number one in Britain with Anyone Who Had a Heart, which had been a hit for Dionne in the States. Dionne had not yet had a hit in Britain. And the only time when I had a three-year TV series on Channel 4 in the mid-80s, when we had to take something out of the prepared show, which we had to show to the lawyers before transmission, was when Cilla said that George Martin came to the Olympia Theater in Paris, saw Dionne do Anyone Who Had a Heart, and then, to use a word that sums up her feelings about it, stole it for Cilla. I don't know if she used the exact word, but anyway, Dionne thinks that she might have had her first hit in Britain, not with the next release, which was Walk On By, but with Anyone Who Had a Heart. But Cilla had the hit with Anyone Who Had a Heart. Then, of course, the situation came about with Alfie. When Burke Bacharach and Hal David, who were writing almost all of Dionne's hits, were asked to write a song for the end credits of the film, Alfie, starring Michael Caine. But the producers wanted a British voice, because Michael Caine was a British actor. And so Cilla Black was chosen over Dionne, and she was a bit miffed. Cilla never thought that she'd get the gig. She said, well, I'll record it if Burt Bacharach comes over to London to do it with me. And he did. So she did it with him. And they did something like 32 takes And Bert said to George Martin, who was producing, he said, how are we doing? And George said, I think you'll find you had it on take six. And sure enough, they listened back, and that's the one that became the record. Then, when that was a hit in Britain, Bert said to Dion, I think we should record you on Alfie. And she said, you don't need me on Alfie. You had Cilla Black on the film, and Cher had a top 40 in America. And he said, yes, but we haven't had Dionne Warwick's Alfie. So they did a version of Alfie with Dionne, and that was a top five in America in 1967 and is in the Grammy Hall of Fame. So the way that poor Dionne thinks that Cilla somehow had it in for her, when in fact Cilla did not have it in for her at all, is amusing.
So beyond your sort of BBC tenure, you also were one of the founding broadcasters of Greatest Hits Radio. In your opinion, how has the advent of digital radio helped to modernise the medium? And what effect has that had on bespoke music genres?
Well, I noticed we sort of fast-forwarded through Classic FM, but I have to say that was one of the highlights of my life. And I'm so thrilled to have done that. I had taken piano lessons as a kid. I didn't realize until I'd memorized the first movement of Grieg's Piano Concerto that my teacher was actually hoping I would go in for a career in classical piano, which I had no intention of doing whatsoever, because I knew I wasn't that good. But I always loved classical music, and so to be able to express that on the air was a great honor. I've seen the advent of technology change radio utterly, going back to the late 60s, when cars started putting FM radios in cars. Before that, all music was on AM, and FM basically was just simulcasting AM. But the FM broadcasting frequencies had better music reproduction. And particularly since the so-called underground music, which was musically more sophisticated, had more elements into it, was becoming more popular, music very quickly migrated to FM from AM in the 1970s. And AM became the domain of talk radio, for better or worse. And you started having argumentative phone-ins, and the nature of public discourse began to decline, hitting new lows, of course, with cable television and satellite television. Now, with music, it's always followed the technology. You can't hold technology back. And so with the digital services, you don't have to have AM or FM frequencies to transmit. And we now have as many radio stations as the public can justify.
Yeah.
It used to be that the government had to decide what use to make of very few frequencies. I remember during the premiership of Margaret Thatcher, going to a speech by Willie Whitelaw, who was Home Secretary, and somebody said, why can't we have a commercial radio station on such and such a frequency? And he said, well, it would interfere with transmissions from Albania. Well, of course, Albania was not transmitting to Britain. It's just that in Albania, there was a radio station on that frequency. And I mean, I knew that was a bit of a ridiculous excuse, but the government was trying to control the number of frequencies. And now there's no holding back. Pirate radio showed that in the 80s. And now we have stations popping up wherever they can be supported. And you mentioned Greatest Hits Radio, which, of course, is aiming for many of the listeners who feel that they have been abandoned by the conventional BBC breakdown of stations. And then there's boom radio, which is very popular as well. I mean, the success of Greatest Hits Radio has genuinely surprised me. In the latest ratings, it's been the fastest growing station. It went up by 25%. It's now over 4 million a week. Radio 1 is down to 7.67 million a week. So suddenly you think, oh my God, it's not inconceivable that within the next few years there'll be a commercial network that gets more than a BBC network. But there are so many out there now. There's the whole global group, which takes up about 40% of radio listening. And we've never had so much choice. Plus, of course, smart devices, which are intimidating. I don't dare name mine in case it comes on and does something. It's the richest time for people who have wanted to listen to music in my lifetime.
So as a broadcaster, then how important do you think it is to remain on that sort of cutting edge of new music and new music technology?
Well, it doesn't matter in terms of staying on the cutting edge of new music because not everyone is invited to play new music. We now have stations and shows within other stations that are specifically aimed at older recordings. And that's where I have been cast since 2015. That's actually fine for me because it was in 2015 that Radio 2 stopped my show America's Greatest Hits. My last number one was Justin Timberlake. Mm. Now, since then, streaming has taken over, which means that the number one is almost always a record with what would be language difficulties for the BBC. Most of the hip hop records, as you know, this is no accusation and no surprise, contain a few language problems. Mm. Not language problems if you don't care what people say, but language problems if you're the BBC. Okay. So I darted that bullet. Now, however, you also asked how important it is it for you to keep on the cutting edge of technology? And the answer is you have no choice. You have to. You have to be able to adjust. I find this fascinating because when I was in high school, we had a series of aptitude tests. And my worst was mechanical aptitude. And that means don't ask me to change a tire or fix a computer or do anything like that. But when it comes to learning the new board, as we call the radio station dials, I'm there. I mean, I've learned so many different ways of flying the plane. Going back to the days when I started, when we actually sliced reel-to-reel tapes with razor blades and taped them up again. If you were doing newscasts and you wanted to make edits in long speeches or something. So I knew how to use razor blades, which is incredible because don't let me near a razor blade in real life. But for broadcasting purposes, I was fine. And I've learned all of the boards, all of the computer touch screens since they were introduced. And that's just because I have to. And because I love it enough, I love broadcasting enough, that even though I think, why do we need this new one? But I'll do it, and I'm there. It's much, much harder, almost impossible now, to sustain a broadcasting career without learning the desk.
Yeah. So, last two questions, same for everybody. Looking back at your career, what is your proudest achievement?
Well, it changes depending on what the focal point of the question is. In a very personal sense, I'm very proud that I hosted the very first network television program for gay and lesbian people, which was on Channel 4. It was called Out on Tuesday. And the production team said, would you host one of these programs? And I said, well, yes, provided it's the first, because I knew that the first one was going to get all of the critical attention. And I thought we might get into a load of controversy, which we did not. We thought that there were going to be politicians and campaigners calling up saying, stop this outrageous program. Nobody did. And as a matter of fact, in the reviews, it was the lead review of the week in The Observer. And the thing they pointed out the most was that I had a Cheshire cat-like grin. I mean, it wasn't even about the subject matter. But the fact that we did it, that meant a lot to me. Now, from a professional point of view, Live Aid, it has to be. Live Aid was the highlight of all our careers. And, I mean, you go on the internet now, you can still see my interviews with Bowie and Bono and The Edge and Brian May and Roger Taylor and Mark Knopfler. It just was our generation all came together. This was the offering of our generation to the world. And I'm very proud to have been there and been a part of that. Also, just the fact that I've sustained this long. Next year will be my 50th year as a network broadcaster. And I remember about 20 years ago when Trevor Nelson was asked, who do you admire in broadcasting? And he said, well, Paul Gambaccini, not because I particularly enjoy what he does, but just the fact that he sticks around. Longevity is an achievement in itself. David Hamilton said to me at the 10th anniversary of Radio 1 in 1977, he said, I really admire people like you. And I said, what are you talking about? You and Tony are at the peak of the profession, meaning that Tony Blackburn and David Hamilton were the most important disc jockeys on Radio 1 at that time. And he said, yeah, but when you're at the peak, you come down. People like you are always there. And I've thought of that phrase for the rest of my life, always there. And I guess if I'd had a goal, once I got onto Radio 1, it was to be like Patrick Moore, who was the astronomer, who for decades was always asked to introduce astronomy programs. If there was an astronomy program, they asked him. They didn't ask him if there was a farming program or if there was a cricket match, but he had longevity because he had one thing. And I guess my one thing has been knowledge of music, I guess. And I'm thrilled to have had an entire career in broadcasting without ever having to make up a CV. I tell you, what a relief that's been.
Yeah. Josh said that's true. When he was doing the research for this interview, it's, you know, you've been there at every major turn of music. So it's, you know, testament to you, I suppose. Congratulations.
Well, thank you so much. And Josh, thank you for your interest in me and stay interested in music, because it'll be a companion for your whole life.
So what's next? What's next for Paul Gambaccini? Anything exciting?
Well, you know, I never say things that haven't happened yet for fear of jinxing them. But at least I have a couple of ideas that I'm going to work on. So I haven't felt the urge to retire, which, of course, some of my college classmates have done. Many of my college classmates have now retired, but I still have things I want to do. So that keeps me going, and I'm thrilled by that. But also I'm just thrilled that I continue to have a relationship with the public, because needless to say, all of the radio executives are different from the ones that were executives when I started out. It's the relationship you have with the listeners that's the important thing. And I do get stopped in the street all the time by people who have nice things to say. And that is a great thrill. And I would like to keep going as long as I am welcome by these people, because it's a great privilege to be trusted with giving to them the music that you love.